that a arbitrary message to a distinct message digest. Distinct, not unique, but distinct enough for there to be unlikely that two messages end up with the same value. Right. So then we said we can estimate the amount of effort needed to find collision on a hash, collision being the easiest attack, finding any two messages with the same hash value, as being 2 to the n divided by 2, where n was the length in bits of the output of the hash. Right. So do we need special hash functions, or can we just use other cryptographic functions we already have? So in theory, using a block cipher would have good hash properties, right? Because if you can make a way to sort of encrypt all the messages, all the message blocks in your message intricately, then you should end up with something that is quite a nice representation or digest of the entire message, right? Think almost like if I did CVC mode encryption in some way where we basically or something similar where we keep changing the chaining the previous block to the next blocks, right? But now without a key, right? Because in theory, block ciphers give us quite good property, right? Small modification in the plain text will be big modification in the ciphertext, right? It is a very good pseudo-random function, so it's difficult to basically see the output and link it back to the input. All sorts of nice properties, right? So could we do that, and would it be a good idea? So we could, for example, say, okay, we're going to build a hash in the following way. So the first intermediate hash value would be a 0. Then we can compute hash 1 is equal to the encryption using message 0 as the key, and basically hash 0 as the data that's being encrypted. And we just keep running it like this until we run out of message blocks, right? And we use the final block, h, as the hash value, right? So the length of the message is the multiple of the key size. So why should we not do this, right? What was the block size for AES? Anyone remember? It was 128 bits, right? Block size for AES was 128, for DES it was 64. So the block size will determine the size of the hash value, right? And while a block cipher with a key of 128 bits, if we wanted to brute force for that key, it was 2 to the 127, which is quite a lot of effort. If we're going to take a block cipher like AES and try to build a hash function with it and get a hash of length 128 bits, what is the effort needed to search for a collision? 2 to the what? 2 to the 64 only, right? Because it's n divided by 2. And 2 to the 64 is not a lot of effort, right? Still a lot of effort, but comparatively it's not a lot of effort. We said people are already searching for DES in a couple of minutes 20 years ago, and the DES effort to find a key is 2 to the 55, right? Is that a 56-bit key? So 2 to the 64 is not very difficult to do computationally in modern day crypto. So the problem with this is that block ciphers, their block sizes are just too small. They were designed for something different. So if we want to use it for a hash, then it would be a poor candidate because the block size is too small. Your digest length is going to be too short. So we're not going to go into a lot of detail when we talk about hash functions, but we can basically talk about some of the underlying architecture, how it works. So in the past, and we take, the first step we take is, so in the past, the main architecture that people used was local NOMGUARD. So the first step is to take our message and split it up into plaintext blocks, which is equal to the block size of our hash function. So the block size could be r bits. Okay? And then we split up our message, and if our message is not an exact multiple of r, we can pad the end of it so we have an exact multiple of r. Then for Merkle DOM guard, we said we're going to take an initialization vector or initial value. We're going to put it into the hash function together with P0. It's going to give us like hash 1 or hash 0. We're then going to take hash 0 together with P1 to get hash 1. And we're going to keep doing this until we feed in all our plain text, all previous ciphertext values. And the last hash value that comes out of the system is then going to be our message digest, our hash value result. Right? So in this design, the size that we feed in, the size R, always stays the same. And the amount of times that we do the hash function then depends purely on how long the message is. The longer the message, the longer the hash function runs. Right? And every single time we block stays exactly the same. And when we finish everything, this is the hash result that comes out. And the hash result is the stated size of the hash algorithm. For more modern hash functions, such as SHA-3, they started using a slightly different design. So they call this a sponge design. The idea is just like a sponge, it can keep absorbing water, or you can keep forcing it to absorb water. And then once you are finished absorbing, you can choose how hard you squeeze it and how much water you squeeze out of it again. Right. So there's two different steps. The first one is the absorbing, and the second part is the squeezing. So the absorbing is basically taking the message into the hash algorithm. So the internal state of the hash is size R plus size C. So your internal state that keeps updating is R plus C bits long. And the size of R is variable. So one can choose how much of the message you will read in every round of the hash calculation, right? And you basically will keep doing this until you fed in all of your message, okay? And then once that is finished, you will start squeezing out the hash result. And once again, you can choose how much of this data comes out every round and contributes to your final hash function. So this could also be size of R, and you can keep squeezing out more and more and more, and your final hash function is basically the first output concatenated with the second output concatenated with how many other outputs you want to have. So this design has various advantages. So for the Merkle DOM guard, we didn't really have any option to really customize it. You basically have to stick with a fixed block size of P0 being fed in, and the internal state, which contributed to the fixed length output, always had to stay the same. Right? It was determined by the size of P0 and the size of the hash function. For the sponge, it allows people to have a trade-off. You can have one single algorithm, but you can have different trade-offs between speed and security. Right? The basic trade-off is that the less of the message I read in every round, and the more rounds I go through, the more secure the hash would be. But of course, then I make it slower, right? Because I have more rounds, because my block size is smaller. Alternatively, I can make my block size much bigger, which means I absorb the message much quicker, but then it might be slightly less secure. Similarly, with my output, I can make my size R quite small. That means I go through many rounds to squeeze out a hash function that's long enough to be considered secure. Or I can make my R larger, which means I squeeze out the required length of hash digest faster. So it's very easy to see this trade-off between how fast I can process the data versus I can go slower and make it more secure. It's actually quite an interesting design concept. Right, so to summarize hash functions and signatures, so a hash function is intended to take a message of any length and map it to a message representative digest of a shorter fixed length that's going to be definitely smaller than the modulus of the signature scheme that we are going to use. Okay, so Alice is going to take her message, she's going to hash that message, this is going to give her the hash. She's then going to use her private key, she's going to sign the hash, is then going to send the signature together with the message to Bob. Bob is going to take the message. Bob is going to hash the message. Bob is then going to take the hash of the message, the signature value, and Alice's private key, and verify the signature. And then the result will either be true or false, or valid or invalid. And Bob can say, yes, the signature that I received matches the message that I received. Therefore, I am quite certain that Alice has made this message and that it has not been modified. Okay. So, there's lots of popular crypto hashes. So, as we said before, we have MD5. It has a 128-bit output that already sounded a little bit short, so people don't really use MD5 anymore. And it has also had much more serious flaws for quite some time. We can have Secure Hash Algorithm 1. So, it's similar to MD5 in its internal designs, but it has 160-bit output. It was, once again, I think the first government standard, just like sort of where we went for encryption from everybody using sort of their own thing, going from DES to AES. SHA-1 was sort of the first NIST-driven secure hash algorithm. Subsequently, there's also SHA-2. So that it's basically also based on SHA-1, but the hash values are longer. So rather than having 160-bit output, you can use, choose 224, 256, 384, or 512. So in terms of the security of these hash functions, MD5 got broken 20 years ago, right? So some researchers showed that it was very easy to find collisions for MD5, right? But they could find many collisions in a very short amount of time. A year later, they also showed some attacks on SHA-1, and they said that the effort to find a collision could be reduced to 2 to the 69, which is a nice academic result, but practically maybe not that much different to 2 to the 8. Because remember, SHA-1's output is 160 in length, so the theoretical resistance we expect to just brute force searching for a collision would be 2 to the 80. The 2 to the 69 is less than 2 to the 80, but it hasn't completely broken it entirely, right? So as a result, basically, MD5 is not used anymore, and SHA-1 is not really recommended for applications where collisions resistance is really important. But it still might be fine in some other cases where we use it to build HMAX, or we only care about secondary image resistance or one-wayness, right? Just not for collisions. So basically from 2008, this recommends that SHA-1 is not used if collision resistance is an important security aspect of the system for people to start using SHA-2. Right. So just to give some practical context on that. So in reducing the effort from 2 to the 80 to 2 to the 69, what is the practical implementation of that? Right? It's still roughly 590 billion computations. Right? So even if you had some serious computing power, it would still take you a very long time. Right? So, for example, if you had a huge GPU server farm, let's say you have some NVIDIA V100s, and you had 1,250 of those, and they were all dedicated only to find a collision on SHA-1 using this specific technique that gives you 2 to the 69 effort, it would take you a year. Right? So for practical purposes, this is not just going to happen randomly. Right? It would probably be an attacker that is quite seriously after something. Right? If everybody, last time we had the example of Bitcoin mining, we said that basically, Bitcoin at its height had about the capacity worldwide to have all the miners together. They could do 2 to the 65 hashes per second. Right? So, of course, if everybody tries to find a collision on SHA-1, they would find one in a couple of seconds. So, just as a side note to that, for Bitcoin, if you're doing the proof of work, you're not trying to find a collision. It's more relevant to it's somewhere between one-wayness and secondary image resistance, actually. Because what they will do is they will release a hash value, and then they will say, what is the value that made this hash? And you have to keep searching for random numbers of a given length until you can find the hash of the message that gives the given hash argument. Once you find it, then you can have the bitcoin. Right. So it's slightly different. But collision problem. But if we were to do collisions, there would be one every 2 seconds. Right. So that is a lot of effort just for somebody to make a random attack. Okay? And we also have to think about the practicality of this. So one of the issues we can say is, if we are using our hash function with a signature, and it's easy to find a collision, the drawback is that there's two messages with the same signature. Right? So if I'm Bob, and I find X and Y that has the same signature, that has the same hash function result, then I can sign X, and I can send it to Alice, and Alice will say, yes, your signature matches for message X. And when Alice then comes back to me and says, okay, time to do what you said in message X, and I tell her, no, but I never send it to you. And she says, no, but I've got a digital signature here that says you sent message X. And then suddenly I send her message Y, and I'm like, no, I actually sent message Y. And she'll find that message Y also has a valid signature outcome on that signature, right? Because if message X and message Y gives us the same hash result, and we are signing the hash, then the signature for these two messages will always be the same. And that would be a problem. So that sounds fine, but now you actually also have to think practically. It's fine to go find random message X and random message Y to give us the same hash value, right? But it's going to be a little bit hard to find messages that have actual value, right? If I tell Alice I want to buy 100 computers and I want to make a second message that hashes to the same value, that is going to be pretty hard. You have to be pretty smart. Maybe somewhere in that email that I sent Alice, I would have to slip in some random values, like a picture or some random thing that I could change to try and find the hash collision. Because it's not going to be just as simple as or neat as I want to buy 100 computers versus I don't want to buy any computer. Right? That's not necessarily going to be your hash collision. The biggest problem, actually, apart from it maybe being practical or not, and then having an issue with digital signature, is more the reputational aspect. Right? The moment somebody comes and says, I've broken SHA-1, and it's now easier to find collisions than it should be, suddenly you have an issue in trust. Right? And then some funny things can start happening. Because remember, ideally we want this to use this for non-repudiation. Non-repudiation means we want to prove that somebody was involved to somebody else, and that might involve taking them to court or suing them or making a case, right? And then if we get into some trust issues or reputational issues, that can make it quite difficult. So there's one story that illustrates this. So there was a gentleman in Australia, he was driving along, he was driving too fast, and then he got caught by a speeding camera. So the camera took a photo of him speeding. And the way the internal of the camera worked is that the camera would take the speed reading, it would take the photo of the car showing the license plate, and then it would do a digital signature of this data, right? And it so happened that it used SHA-1 as the hash for doing this digital signature. This man then decided that he doesn't want to pay the ticket, which meant the police had to go to court to basically criminally prosecute him to try and get the ticket. And his lawyer came up and said, well, I've got this academic paper that says collisions on SHA-1 is now possible. So therefore, it could have been easy for somebody else to create this data and appear to be a valid digital signature. There's, of course, also the practical problems with this, but this was the legal argument. Right? And the judge said, well, given that this is a criminal case and I need to convict this person without any doubt whatsoever, because the burden of proof for criminal case is beyond any doubt, I cannot say that this person for sure was the person on the camera and he doesn't have to pay his speeding fine. Okay? So in a way, that was quite smart to come up with that argument. In a way, the judge also doesn't really understand how a hash function works or how a digital signature works because it's not his job. But that is the type of thing that's going to happen. The moment somebody says it's now easy to do it, even though in practice it's not really that easy to do anything with it practically, the moment the trust in the mechanism erodes and you needed to convince other people that it's trustworthy, you might have a point. Right. Okay. So SHA-1 used only a limited context, MD4 and MD5 not used anymore. SHA-2 being the one that most people use now in practice. That said, people sort of learned from AES. So for DES, they waited too long, right? So they already knew DES had some issues, but they sort of tried to keep it alive, and then they had to end up with lots of variations before they finally came up with AES. So this time around, they basically said, okay, people are already starting to do things to SHA-1 and to MD5. Let's just try and get a good thing for the future going now. We might not need it yet, but then it's ready to go. So in 2007, NIST launched a similar AES-style competition to find the next secure hash algorithm, or SHA-3. It was exactly the same as AES. They had a big open competition to basically ask anyone to submit their design. They got 63 submissions. 51 was then selected for first round review. There were 14 semi-finalists, and finally there was 5 finalists in 2010. And then similar to with AES, they then went through the 5 finalists, and 2 years later they chose the winner, which was KJAC. Right? And KJAC is a sponge architecture secure hash algorithm. It has variable length output and it has variable throughput. In other words, you can have variable input and variable output, and you're basically able to do this trade-off between speed and security. Right? Currently, not a lot of people use it, but it's intended to. So at the moment, it sort of works with and not against SHA-2. So you can sort of use them together rather than replacing SHA-2. And then the one interesting thing is that one of the people who designed it, so this was actually an industry collaboration between STMicroelectronics and NXP. So one of the co-designers was John Garman, that also happened to design AES. So for both the SHA-3 and for the AES, he is a co-designer of both. Right. So that's hash functions and digital signatures. It brings us to message authentication. So message authentication is maybe a little step down from digital signatures, as it cannot provide us with non-repudiation. But it is still important, right? So message authentication or data origin authentication wants to make sure that the message we receive is real and unmodified, but we might not have to prove it to somebody else, right? So if we think about some basic things, if we maybe think about some banking. So all the banks sit on a secure network, it's called the SHIFT network, right? And there might be some interbank transfers or some payment settling between them. So the confidentiality is nice, but overall the network is confidential and secure in any way. But your integrity is very important. You don't want errors, you don't want modifications to come in, and then data gets corrupted or modified or larger amounts get transferred than what you want. Right. It's also probably unlikely that because all the entities trust each other already, that you're going to really need things like non-repudiation. So in some cases where Alice and Bob is going to trust each other already, or maybe there's some other non-repudiation measures like trusted third parties or notarization or transaction recording, you might not necessarily need digital signatures. So you want like a slightly smaller, easier to use transaction that is faster to compute to allow for more transactions, but you lose the non-repudiation. Right. So in this case, we can use message authentication. Right. So what is message authentication or the message authentication code? So unlike the digital signature, the message authentication code is a symmetric cryptographic mechanism. So the sender and the receiver both have the same secret key K. The sender will take the message. They will calculate the map using this key K. They will concatenate that to the message, and they'll send both to the recipient. The recipient will then take the received message, calculate the MAC using its version of the secret key, and then compare its MAC to the MAC that was sent with the message. And if the two are the same, then we assume that the message has been unmodified and the message indeed has come from source A. Right? Well, the message has been unmodified since source A has made it. Right. So if we compare it to a hash, because now we've already looked at a hash and digital signature. If we compare it to a hash, both map arbitrary long messages to a fixed length output. Right? However, a MAC requires a key to calculate, whereas a hash did not. Anyone can calculate a hash. When we compare it to a digital signature, it is much faster to compute because it's symmetric crypto. We know that symmetric encryption is faster than asymmetric encryption. Right? But the MAC does not provide non-repudiation. So why does a MAC not provide non-repudiation? Non-repudiation means somebody has done something and I can prove that that person has done it. So when they say they haven't done it, I can prove that indeed they have done it. The reason a digital signature provides non-repudiation is because there's only one person with the private key, right? Because Alice has private public key, gives everybody her public key. Her private key is always secure. She signs things with her private key. No one else should have her private key, which means if she signs something, it must be Alice. For a message authentication code, Alice has a symmetric secret key. Bob has a symmetric secret key. Right? Alice sends a message to Bob. Bob can verify that Alice sent him that message because she's the only other one with this key. So it works from a data origin authentication perspective. However, if Alice now goes off and says, I never sent you this message, Bob is in trouble because he can't go to anyone else and says, Alice sent me this message with a MAC. That means Alice must have sent me this message. Because if Bob goes to another person and tells them the story, they're going to say, but don't you have the key as well? And then Bob will have to admit that he does. So Bob could, in theory, also have made up the message and calculated the MAC of that message. Because in a symmetric system, we always have at least two people in the system that have this shared key. Right? So we can no longer say, only Alice could possibly have done this. Alice and Bob could not have done this. Right? Sender and recipient could have done this. So we lose the non-repudiation. So in general, the thing to remember is, when we talk about non-repudiation, we cannot really provide it with any type of symmetric crypto. Right? Because in symmetric crypto, there's always multiple people with a secret. Whereas in asymmetric crypto, there's only one person with a specific secret. That provides us the non-repudiation. Right? Okay. So how could we build MAC algorithms? Right? So there's actually two ways. We can build CBC MAC, or we can build hash MACs. So how does CBC MAC work? Simply, we're going to do CBC mode encryption with initial value of 0, and we're going to throw away all the intermediate blocks and only keep the last block. So we have a message P0, P1, P2, and P3, and we have a secret shared PK. We're going to have C0 as the encryption of P0, C1 is the encryption of C0 and P1, C2 is the encryption of C1 XOR to P2, and until we get to the final ciphertext block, with the final plaintext block. And then we're going to throw away C0, C1, C2, and everything that's on between, and we're going to simply keep the last ciphertext value as our MAC value. Right. So why does this MAC implementation work? Because for CBC mode, the current ciphertext value depends on the current plaintext value, but also all previous plaintext values. Right? So if I have message P0, P1, P2, and P3, and I calculate the MAC across this by encrypting everything with CBC mode, and I only keep C3 as my MAC value, and I send that to Bob, and along the line Trudy comes and changes, let's say, P1 to X, when Bob then does the recalculation of the MAC, C0 is the encryption of P0, C1 is going to be the encryption of C0 and X, because it's no longer P1, which means C1 is going to be different. But C2 is dependent on C1 and P2, so C2 is going to be different. And C3 is dependent on C2, so C3 is going to be different. So the MAC tag that Bob is going to calculate is going to be different. So CVC mode is very good at detecting whether everything in the anything in the message that's being encrypted has changed. And any change in the message will propagate right until the end. Right. The one thing about this is that this is the basic way that CVC map works. Right? In reality, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because there's one attack where you can basically stitch different messages together if you do it only in this way. Right? So normally, if we just do it like this, and we can have variable length messages, we are leaving ourselves a little bit vulnerable to combination attacks or stitching at that. So in real life, if they do CVC MAC, they would basically do CVC encryption for everything, and then after they get the final block, they will do one additional permutation. And that additional permutation result will then be the MAC value. So what would happen if we just use CVC MAC conventionally? Then we can do the following. If the attacker has two messages, so the attacker has two valid messages and two valid MAC values for those two messages, the attacker can basically combine them together in such a way that the MAC value, the valid MAC value for the new combined message is equal to the MAC value for the second conventional message, legitimate message. So how does this work? If we have one message, which is P1 and P2, and we have a second message, it's this P3, then anyone can basically make a new message, which is P1, P2, P3 XOR to the MAC value for P1 and P2, and the MAC value for this new message would then be the MAC value for the original second message. So how does this work? So if we calculate the MAC value for the first message, C0 is the encryption of P1. The MAC value is equal to C1, which is the encryption of C0 XOR to P2, right? And for the second message, the MAC value is just C0, which is the encryption of P3. So now the attack value, attack message, is the two sort of combined. So P1, P2, and P3 XOR to T dash, right? So if I send my modified message off to a valid recipient, to validate the MAC, the recipient is going to go C0 is the encryption of P1, C1 is the encryption of P2, and C2 is the encryption of C1, XOR to P3, XOR to T dash, because this is what I've set my third block to be as an attacker. But what do we know about C1? C1 is also equal to T dash, right? Because C1 is the MAC value for the first message, which was P1 and P2. So we basically now end up with the encryption of T dash XOR to P3 XOR to T dash. So if we XOR something to itself, it becomes 0. And if we XOR something to a 0, it has no impact. So basically, the two T dashes disappear and we are left with P3. And the encryption of P3 is basically equal to the second MAC tag, T double dash. So therefore, it is equal to T double dash. So the MAC tag for the third message is just equal to the MAC tag for the original second part of the message. Alright? So that means, without knowing the key or anything, I'm managing to combine two different messages together by just setting the linking block to the first block of the second message, XOR to the MAC value of the first message. That's why we normally do a final permutation here. So after we calculate this, there will be one more block operation to try and prevent this. Right. So why does this work? Because by choosing our linking block in this way, we basically make the system forget about everything that went before. Right? So we've basically done CVC mode with P1 and P2, but by the time we get here to calculate C2, basically we're only working with P3. So in theory, for CVC mode, C2 should be dependent on P3 and P1 and P2. But we've now essentially tricked the system into forgetting about P1 and P2, and also only working from P3 onwards, as a P3 was the first message block to be sent. Okay. I will do like a more longer example of this in the tutorial for lecture 5. Okay. So the other way we can build a MAC function is using an HMAC or a hash function. So what we will do here is we'll basically take a key value, we'll concatenate the message, and we'll calculate the hash of that. And we'll take that hash result, we'll concatenate it with a second key, and we'll hash it again. Okay? So the architecture shown here is sort of k times k XOR to OOPAD and k XOR to IPAD, but this just means that the two keys are different. So in a system where we have one single key, it's basically doing a variation of the key to make a HMAC key 1 and doing a variation of the key to make a HMAC key 2. So we can just as well say we hash the concatenation of key 1 at M, we take the result concatenated to key 2, and then we hash everything to find our HMAC. So an HMAC is essentially a hash that we've introduced a key value into. Right, so for our HMAC, we can also call them, some people can sometimes informally call that a key MAC, right? So sometimes you'll see a hash of the key with the message, right? So an HMAC goes two ways, so it's iterative. So first we hash the key with the entire message, then we hash the hash output with a new key, right? So we've talked about integrity and confidentiality, so we've now talked about MAC functions, hashes, signatures, to some final comments. So we talked about integrity and confidentiality and doing both together. So what is the implications for this? How would we do it? Should we encrypt the data first and then do the integrity over the ciphertext? So we encrypt the MAC, or should we rather do the MAC and then the encrypt? Right? So this is a little bit of a debate, and I guess it comes down to implementation issues. So from a purist perspective, encrypted MAC probably makes it makes more sense from a logical perspective to say the MAC should be on the plain text, and then we'll encrypt the plain text together with encrypt, right? Alternatively, some other people say, okay, well, even though it makes sense to say, well, the MAC is really ensuring the integrity of the plaintext, we should rather MAC the ciphertext. So there's some benefits to this, such as if I do MAC and encrypt, I first have to decrypt everything and then check the integrity. If the integrity then fails, I basically wasted my time doing the decryption, right? Whereas for encrypted MAC, I can check the integrity first. If the integrity fails, I don't even bother to decrypt. Okay. We also have to think about how this practically happens. Let's say we use a mode of operation to encrypt, and then we also want to calculate a MAC. Right? So the implication is that we're going to have to go through all the data twice. Right? Let's say we're using CVC mode to encrypt. Now we are going to encrypt all our 100 blocks, let's say. Now we have our ciphertext. Now we want to calculate the MAC. Now we have to go through 100 blocks again, with a different key. Your MAC and your encryption key is not the same key, right? And we only keep the last block, right? So we have basically had to be forced to work through the data twice. So there's also a question about, is there any more efficient way to do that? So I think generally, and some people have showed it, and it's up for debate in how your application specifically work, but in the past there have been some issues related to MAC and encrypt, and some people think encrypted MAC is a little bit better. I don't think there's an exact science to how this would work. There are better ways to do both at the same time, though. So one interesting attack that comes from the implementation of the encryption and the integrity on one single message is called the padding oracle attack. So the padding oracle attack assumes that we are using CVC mode to encrypt, and also CVC MAC implementation. And what basically happens, remember, with a MAC, if we're decrypting with CVC mode, What we are doing is we are decrypting the last ciphertext package. So if we have C0, C1, and C2, if we decrypt C2, that's going to give us a value, and we have to XOR it to C1 to give us our plaintext. Right? From an attacker's perspective, they already know C1. So if an attacker can try and figure out the value here, so this is going to be, if they can figure out the last byte of the value here that is correct, they can XOR it to the last bit of C1 to actually find the plaintext. Right? But how could they do this if they don't have the key? So when studying some of the common implementations of, I think it was SSL or TLS, they found out that in true computer science form, the people who coded it wanted to give people as much information as possible. So actually what the libraries did was it gave you a lot of technical information when it said it was an error. So if I try to decrypt data, rather than just say your decryption failed, it tried to give me a reason why the decryption failed. And one of the reasons it gave was actually that there was a back padding error. In other words, your padding box at the end for your back was incorrect. Okay? And then somebody came along and said, but actually this could help us find plaintext. Right. So how does the padding work? So the standard padding standard that most people use is PKCS is 7. So it says if I'm padding 1 byte, it's 0,1. If I'm padding 2 bytes, it's 0,2. If I'm padding 3 bytes, it's 0,3. So then I have 0,3, 0,3, 0,3. Right? So they basically said if you can basically fool the system into checking whether the padding is correct, and it tells you the padding is not correct, you know that this last byte here is not equal to 0,1. So you're only looking for the first byte. So the attacker, when feeding it to the person who's doing the decryption, can basically play around with this last byte of C1. And the idea is if you play around with this last byte of C1 and put it at different values, because this value here is always going to be the same. The value that decrypts here is always going to be the same. And we're trying to figure out what it is. And now we have a choice to vary the last byte of this C1 until the value is 0,1. Because if the value is 0,1, it's not going to give us an error. If the value is anything but 0,1, then it is going to give us an error. So we can keep just changing this, so we can run through the 256 possible values of the byte until we don't get a padding error. Then we know the value that we had, XOR to this value that we don't know, is 0.01. Right? And once that happens, we know what this value is, and we can XOR it to the real value of C1 to find basically the last plaintext block of P2. And then we can do exactly the same for the last two blocks, for the last three blocks, for the last four blocks, and eventually we can read out the entire plaintext message. So then they went off and fixed it, and then about 10 years after that, people realized that the problem hadn't really gone away. It's just that now you don't get a message anymore, but they found out that you fed some things into somebody decrypting the data and waited for the response, some responses would take longer than other responses. So something similar could happen. It would basically, you would be able to see, oh, the MAC value failed, because the error response took 5 milliseconds to come back. Whereas if it's correct, it takes 10 milliseconds to come back. Right, so you could use this timing analysis to find information about what is going on. Right. The other thing people have started doing is that we don't necessarily have to encrypt and then do integrity separately. So there's an entire different family of mode of operation which allows for something called authenticated encryption. So in other words, rather than do encryption and then MAC, and there's basically two encryption operations per block, we can use an authenticated encryption mode of operation that does both at the same time. So the example here is called GCM, or rather our counter mode, and it uses basically counter mode encryption, and at the same time it calculates a MAC value. So you only have to go through the data once, right? So you can see at the top when we start with a counter, and we increment the counter, and we encrypt it, and we XOR it with plaintext to get ciphertext. We increment the counter, we encrypt it, and we XOR it with plaintext to get the ciphertext. That's basically the counter mode we looked at in lecture 2, right? But at the same time, we encrypt counter 0, and then every single time we have ciphertext, we start off with some authentication data, like an initial hash value or an initial MAC value. We go through a permutation, we XOR it to C1, we go through a permutation, we XOR it to C2, until we run out of ciphertext. We do a final two permutations, we XOR it to the first block, and this becomes our authentication tag. Right? And our authentication tag is like our MAC tag. And later when we talk about TLS, we'll see that in the later cipher suite for TLS version 3, all the allowable crypto operations are basically null or authenticated. So authenticated encryption is just a mode of operation for a block cipher that allows for the integrity check and the encryption to be done at the same time. Okay, so to finish off, just a final note on signatures, because I realized 2 years ago that some people want to ask about this, so I just put it for interest. I said that we would study RSA, and RSA is quite unique because the maths for the signature and the encryption is the same, right? In the last lecture, we looked at Algol encryption. There's an Algol signature scheme, but it is not the same. It also relies on the discrete logarithm problem, but it is different. I just want to make it clear what the difference is, right? So for RSA, we said the signature was the hash raised to the private exponent, modulus s, and to do the signature verification, we did the signature to the power e, which is the public exponent, modulus n, and this should give us our hash value back, the actual hash value, right? So this is another thing about RSA that's slightly different. The maths for the encrypt and the signature is the same. And RSA is an example of signature with message recovery. In other words, if you verify the signature, your original thing that you sign will appear again. Right. So let's look at some other examples. So this is Algol signature. So there's a private key X, there's a base G, a prime P, a random K, and your hash value. So you're going to calculate your public key as y is equal to g to the x mod p, r is equal to g to the k mod p, s is equal to the hash minus x times r times the modular inverse of k modular p1, and your signature has two parts, r and s. And then to verify, the recipient will calculate the hash value, raise g to the power of the hash modular p, and then calculate a second value, y to the r, times r to the s modulo p. And if these two values match, this signature matches. Right? But unlike RSA, the hash that the sender has signed does not appear again. Right? The recipient only has his version of the hash. This is the sender's version of the hash. This is the receiver's version of the hash that they calculate. They use it in the calculation, but they simply get two values, and if the two values are the same, the signature is correct. And for DSA, similar, y is equal to g to the x mod p, r is g to the k mod p mod q, s is equal to the modular inverse of k modular q, times the hash of m times x times r, plus x times r. So hash of m here is the hash message that the sender has calculated. And then your signature has two parts. And then the verification is actually quite tricky. So W is the modular inverse of S modulo Q. U1 is now the hash value that the receiver has calculated times W modulo Q. U2 is R times W modulo Q. And then finally we calculate V, which is G to the U1 times Y to the U1 mod P mod Q. And if this V is equal to the same R, then the message matches the signature. Right. So this one's where the signature doesn't actually give you the original signed value out, but rather have two values that you calculate that's supposed to match, is called signature with appendix. Right. So So that is purely for interest. Just because I think previously I used to ask a question, something like, could you use the Algemal Signet encryption scheme we learned in lecture 4 to sign a message? A lot of people would say yes, because they've heard about Algemal Signature. So I basically added the slide in to just show them that it doesn't work that way. So for RSA, it's very special, because the maths for the signature encryption is the same. For other things, even though they call the same thing, Algemal Signature versus Algemal Encryption, the mathematics actually look very, very different. Right? And also the second thing that's interesting is that RSA, when you verify, you get your original signed message out, but for other signature schemes, you actually don't. RSA, I think, is the only real mainstream one that does this. For the other ones, you have to calculate two values, you never see what the original message was, and you have to match the two values to see if it's verified. Okay, so that is the end of the lecture. If you are staying for the tutorial, I will start going through the solutions in about half an hour, at 4:30, right? If you, in the meantime, have any questions to ask me about the lecture, feel free, I'll be at the front. And all the notes and everything will go on to Canvas later. I understood that Canvas was gone for the last week, which wasn't very useful, but hopefully now it's back. Okay? And hopefully you managed to get the problem set before the Canvas gone. I hope. Yes. I managed to get it somewhere else. Okay, so thank you for the lecture, and then